Hello, fellow foodies. Thanks for tuning in. I'm so excited to share this episode with you because it is focused on one of my favorite food transformation techniques. Do you know what that might be? If you guessed fermentation, you'd be right. Fermentation makes food more shelf-stable, nutritious, and delicious. Some ferments can also boost your health through promoting a healthy gut microbiome and by strengthening immunity. The amazing thing is that through implementation of some very simple steps, anyone can start fermenting at home using the wild microbes that are found on vegetables and even on dry flour. In this episode of Foodie Pharmacology, I speak with world-renowned fermenting guru Sandor Katz about the science and history of fermentation. Sandor Elix Katz is a fermentation revivalist. His books, Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, along with the hundreds of fermentation workshops that he has taught around the world, have all helped to catalyze a broad revival of the fermentation arts. A self-taught experimentalist who lives in rural Tennessee, the New York Times calls Sandor, and I quote, one of the unlikely rock stars of the American food scene. Sandor is a recipient of a James Beard Award and other honors. For more information on his work, check out his website at www.wildfermentation.com. I was thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with Sandor over Skype. I hope that you enjoy this conversation too. Well, thank you so much, Sandor, for coming on the show. It was great to meet you in person a couple of months ago and get my copy of Wild Fermentation signed by you. And I've just really enjoyed all of your work in this space, and I'm excited to chat more about fermentation and share it with the Foodie Pharmacology audience.
Well, I'm so happy to be here talking with you.
Great. Well, why don't we start with something really simple and basic? Can you just kind of start from the beginning and explain what is fermentation?
Sure. So, you know, almost every person in almost every part of the world eats and drinks products of fermentation every day. Products of fermentation range from, well, obviously beer and wine, yogurt and cheeses, bread, sauerkraut, kimchi, and different kinds of pickles, coffee, chocolate, vanilla, cured meats, vinegar, condiments, you know, an incredible array of everyday foods and beverages that people enjoy. And what unites all of these foods is that they're produced by the transformative action of microorganisms, bacteria and or fungi, transforming nutrients and transforming the nature of these foods. And, you know, while people have been practicing fermentation for thousands and thousands of years, I mean, the earliest archaeological evidence is about 10,000 years, but, you know, that really just tells us about the history of pottery. And in reality, you know, people, you know, using various biodegradable vessels have been fermenting much, much longer than that, because fermentation is a natural phenomenon. But, you know, we've only understood the nature of fermentation as the transformative action of microorganisms for about 150 years since the work of Louis Pasteur. But what the insight that microbiology has given us is that, you know, all of the food that we eat, all of the plants and all of the animal products that comprise our food are populated by these elaborate communities of microorganisms. So microbial transformation of our food is more or less an inevitability, except in the case of dried foods. And so, you know, really the fermentation arts is, you know, human cultures, you know, using powers of observation and experimentation to learn how to guide these inevitable microbial transformations. So instead of our food decomposing or rotting or spoiling, it is improved in some way. And there's always a practical benefit to fermentation, whether it is producing alcohol, whether it is preserving food, making something perishable more stable, whether it is making something more easily digestible, whether it's simply making it more delicious, whether it's removing some toxic compound from the food. So, you know, fermentation has been a really essential aspect of how people in every part of the world make effective use of whatever food resources are available to them. And it continues to be, you know, important to, you know, culinary traditions in every part of the world to this day.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think the benefits are, like you said, multifold. And I also think of some other countries where perhaps where fuel is scarce. Does fermenting foods also help reduce cooking times, I believe, in some cases as well?
Sure, there are examples of that. I would say that the most vivid example of that perhaps is Indonesian tempeh, which is basically like a cake of fermented soybeans. So if you wanted to cook soybeans until they're soft enough to eat, that's about 5 hours of cooking. And even then, if you eat the cooked soybeans, you're not going to be able to access much of the nutrients that are in them. And they're notorious for indigestion inaccessibility of the proteins. But if you to make tempeh, you just need to cook the beans for about a half an hour, and then there's a 24-hour process of growing this fungus that binds the beans together, and then you would fry them for about 5 to 10 minutes. So basically, you're taking something that would otherwise require about 5 hours of cooking only to give, you know, marginal nutrition. If we ferment it, we, you know, vastly reduce the cooking time from about 5 hours to maybe 40 minutes. You know, and we make the nutrients much, much, much more accessible. So, so yes, I mean, absolutely. There are other cases of that. I mean, also, I mean, in terms of producing biofuels, fermentation is important. I mean, that's how we make ethanol, is through fermentation. People are capturing methane, biogas, through fermentation chambers to cook with and heat with. So, I mean, yes, absolutely. There are lots of other practical applications of fermentation. I mean, soil fertility, fiber arts, animal husbandry. I mean, all kinds of ways beyond, food for us that people, you know, make use of fermentation.
That's great. And I love the idea that you can let the microbes do the work too, right? I guess that's really neat. And how difficult is it to set up a ferment? Like, it sounds really complicated. Can you walk us through an example of just, you know, I don't know, maybe we could start with something simple, like,
Okay, sure. So, I mean, certain fermentation processes have, you know, a little bit more complexity to them. You know, if you wanted to make Camembert cheese, you know, you need to rig up something that has the environmental conditions of a cave, and you need to find certain kinds of organisms if you're not in those caves. So, you know, I mean, certain ferments you know, have more specific or elaborate requirements, but certain ferments are, you know, incredibly, incredibly simple and straightforward. And generally, you know, what I recommend to people as a first ferment is sauerkraut. And sauerkraut was certainly my gateway into fermentation. In 1993, when I moved from New York City to rural Tennessee and had a garden for the first time, I was such a naive city kid that it had never occurred to me that in the garden all the cabbage would be ready at about the same time. And so the first season that I was gardening, when I encountered this like simple, obvious reality of agricultural production, I decided I should learn how to make sauerkraut. I found a recipe in The Joy of Cooking. I couldn't believe how simple and straightforward it was. I couldn't believe how delicious it was. And, you know, that just, got me excited to experiment. Well, what happens if you use radishes instead of cabbages and just, you know, play around with the process a little bit and, you know, figure out more what the parameters were. But I mean, all you have to do to make sauerkraut is you take some vegetables. I mean, it could be cabbage, it could be carrots, it could be radishes, it, you know, could be lots of different kinds of vegetables mixed together. You shred them up. What you're doing is creating surface area. I like to think of the practice of fermentation as manipulating environmental conditions to encourage the growth of certain organisms and simultaneously discourage the growth of other organisms. So when we're fermenting vegetables, what we're trying to do is get the vegetables submerged. If you use whole vegetables or big chunks of vegetables, then what you do is you mix up a salt water brine solution to cover the vegetables with to protect them from the flow of oxygen. But if you shred vegetables, there's no need to add water and dilute flavor. What you're doing is pulling juice out of the vegetables. So you do that by lightly salting them. You know, don't get caught up on the amount of salt. It's always easier to add salt than to subtract salt. So start really light with the salting and lightly salt the vegetables, toss them around a little bit, and you'll notice that they begin to sweat through the physical process of osmosis. Salt starts to draw water out of the vegetables, and so they'll start to get a little bit juicy. You can hasten that by getting in there with your hands, your clean hands, and just squeezing the vegetables, massaging them a little bit. And that breaks down cell walls and releases juice faster. So you're salting and squeezing. And after a few minutes of squeezing the vegetables, they're nice and juicy. You can pick up a little handful, squeeze them, and juice will come out. It's almost like a wet sponge or something. Once they're juicy enough, the juice comes out when you squeeze them, then you know that when you pack them into your vessel, it'll be easy to get them submerged under their own juices. If you happen to be working with really old vegetables that have sat in a refrigerated warehouse for months, they might be dry, or maybe you have carpal tunnel syndrome, or maybe you have arthritis. If you can't do that, just add a little bit of water. That's not a big deal. You know, the reason to not add water is simply that you get a more concentrated flavor from simply the juice of the vegetables, and fresh vegetables are just incredibly juicy. So you shred vegetables, you lightly salt them, you can add other seasonings as you like. You can add caraway seeds, you can add garlic, you can add dill, you can add juniper berries, you can be experimental, whatever you want. Curry kraut, or you can keep it simple and just use salt and no seasonings. And then once you have your juicy vegetables, you stuff them into a vessel. I would say the easiest, most accessible vessel for small-scale fermentation is going to be a quart-size mason jar. The wide-mouth style is a little bit easier to deal with than the narrow-neck style, but, you know, work with what you've got. A quart jar will take about 2 pounds of vegetables to fill it. And then you just pack the vegetables in and try to get the veggies submerged. No matter how juicy it is, the veggies will – oh, I forgot one important thing. Before you pack it in, just taste it, evaluate the saltiness. If you think it needs a little bit more salt, add a little bit of salt. If you have just, you know, just miscalculated and way oversalted it and it just tastes like disgustingly salty, cover the vegetables with a little bit of water, let them sit for a minute, stir them around, and pour some of the water off, and that will remove salt from the vegetables. But it's better to not have to do that.
It's good to have a simple fix, though. That's great. Yeah.
And then you just pack them into your vessel and try to, you know, pack them in a way that holds it down, put a little weight on top. I like to sometimes save an outer leaf of a cabbage with a strong spine and use that spine like a spring to hold them down under the brine, but try to hold it down. And then you just let it ferment. And, traditional fermentation where people are trying to preserve vegetables, you know, to get them through a long, harsh winter, you know, people might leave them in there for months and months, but nobody waited months and months before they tasted them. And then, you know, I would say wait 4 or 5 days, taste it, and then taste it every few days. And the acidity, the sourness will accumulate over time and build over time. And, you know, if it gets to the point where you don't want it to continue to get more strong, more sour, more acidic, then move it to the refrigerator, your fermentation slowing device. And it's that simple.
Wow. That does sound really simple. And like, I like what you said too about the ability to really mix up the flavors by using different vegetables. Can you walk us through the microbiology of what happens after you salt them? So like you're adding salt and vegetables, you're pushing them under the liquid. But how does it transform something like a plain cabbage into something that has that acidic sour taste like that we see in sauerkraut?
Well, okay. So all vegetables, I mean, really more broadly than that, all plants growing out of soil on planet Earth are believed to be host to lactic acid bacteria. Now, of course, lactic acid bacteria are not the only bacteria that are present. There's lots of different kinds of bacteria. And, you know, the big question in fermentation is which of these bacteria are going to develop. And so, you know, let's say you left a bowl of loosely shredded vegetables on your kitchen counter. That is never going to turn itself into sauerkraut. And it's very predictable what will happen. And we've all seen, you know, various levels of this. But all the cut edges of the vegetables where carbohydrates are oozing out in contact with the air are going to develop molds. And especially in a hot, humid environment, a bowl of loosely shredded vegetables left for several days would become like a cloud of hairy white mold. And those hairy white molds could literally reduce a bowl of vegetables to a puddle of slime that bears no resemblance to delicious, tangy, crunchy sauerkraut.
I've definitely had that happen before. Yeah.
The difference is that the molds need oxygen. In an oxygen-rich environment, you know, the molds are always going to be the first thing that grows. But as soon as you submerge the vegetables and protect them from the flow of oxygen, then the molds can't grow anymore. And what will grow every single time are lactic acid bacteria that are there. And as they develop, they will acidify the environment. And I mean, actually, you know, the microbiology of sauerkraut is a little bit more complex because it's a successional process. So there's the lactic acid bacteria that is believed to be universally found on plants is called Leuconostoc miserantoides. And that's generally what initiates a sauerkraut fermentation. But as it acidifies the environment, it sets the stage for the rise of the next strain of bacteria that's going to develop. And you get a series of different strains of lactic bacteria developing until a strongly acidic, late-stage fermented vegetables typically dominated by Lactobacillus plantarum. So as the environment acidifies, you know, the composition of the microbial community shifts.
Yeah, I guess that's also what we see even in our own bodies, humans, you know, within our microbiome. You see changes in your microbiome makeup based on what you eat and based on conditions, the environmental conditions, and the same thing is happening inside your ferment. That's fascinating. So this is
I think that, you know, I mean, it's just important to recognize that microbial communities are very dynamic. They're not staying the same. They're always, you know, they're always shifting. You know, the metabolic byproducts of one bacteria are the food for another bacteria. Even at the level of genetics, bacteria are continually exchanging genetic information and sharing genes. So, I mean, it's just a very, very, you know, dynamic, environment. But, you know, I think that the important thing to people to understand, especially in terms of, you know, our anxiety about bacteria, and, you know, because, you know, we've been told for a century and a half that bacteria are so scary and we need to avoid bacteria and we need to, you know, kill bacteria with, you know, various chemicals that we have. You know, a lot of people project all of this anxiety about bacteria onto the idea of fermenting vegetables. And they're like, how can I be sure that I have, you know, good bacteria that are going to, you know, help maintain good health and not dangerous bacteria that might make me sick or even kill somebody. And, you know, one of the things about sauerkraut is that it's among the safest of foods known. Like, there is no case history anywhere in the world of food poisoning or illness from fermented vegetables. I mean, obviously, we hear every year of food poisoning outbreaks related to raw vegetables. Clearly, there's the possibility that raw vegetables can be exposed to, you know, incidental bacteria that have the potential to make people sick. But, you know, one of the brilliant things about acidification as a strategy for food preservation and food safety is that, you know, none of the food poisoning organisms that we hear the names of, can survive in an acidic environment. So, you know, whether we're talking about Clostridium botulinum or if we're talking about Salmonella or E. coli, you know, what all of these organisms that we fear have in common is that they cannot survive in an acidic environment. And so, you know, from a food safety perspective, I mean, there is no case history. I don't think that there's any need for people at home to be checking the pH of their sauerkraut. But, you know, typically commercial producers are required to check the pH of each batch. And, you know, it is widely understood that at a pH of 4.6 or lower, none of the pathogenic organisms that we worry about can survive. That's why this is such a, you know, reliable strategy for safety.
Yeah. Well, and speaking about fermented vegetables, there's often confusion around pickled vegetables versus fermented vegetables. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that and what is the difference in their preparation?
Sure. Well, I would say that fermented vegetables and pickled vegetables are overlapping categories. So, you know, a fermented vegetable is a vegetable that has, you know, been fermented typically through the action of lactic acid bacteria, and it's preserved by acidity produced by the fermentation. A pickle is anything preserved in an acidic medium. And one way of doing that is fermenting the vegetables. So, like, you know, what got me interested in fermentation is pickles. I mean, my grandparents were immigrants from what's now Belarus. We always had pickles in our refrigerator, the Eastern European style fermented pickles. I mean, it was just basically cucumbers in a saltwater brine, usually with grape leaves, dill, garlic, and sometimes chilies. And, you know, this was just a favorite food of mine. This is what I understood a pickle to be. And then, you know, I grew up, I left home, I would go shopping at the supermarket, and I'd see this row of pickles in the supermarket, and sometimes I'd buy them, and they tasted so different from the pickles I was used to, because mostly they're produced with vinegar. My general understanding is that vinegar pickling became popular in the middle of the 20th century with the advent of what we know as distilled white vinegar, the vinegar that's cheaper than water at the supermarket. Because previous to that, vinegar outside of the major wine growing regions of the world was, you know, it was a luxury. It was, you know, it was much more precious than salt. So most, like, old pickling traditions are basically using fermentation to create the acidity that preserves the vegetables. But with the advent of cheap vinegar, you know, the great advantage of a vinegar pickle is it can sit, you know, on a shelf almost forever. And so it has great, for mass production, for mass marketing, for sort of supermarket culture, it's much more practical than the, you know, more traditional way of, you know, fermentation in a barrel and then putting it in a vessel at the point of sale. Like, I mean, you can actually today buy beautiful fermented vegetables in, you know, natural foods markets and certain upscale supermarket chains, but they always have to be refrigerated, and that makes them much more expensive than vinegar pickles. So a pickle is anything preserved in an acidic medium. You can achieve that through fermentation using lactic acid bacteria, and the acid being lactic acid, or you can achieve that by putting a vinegar solution over vegetables and allowing the acetic acid of the vinegar, which is produced by fermentation, but then typically would be heated up so there's no more fermentation happening, you know, after the vinegar has been added to the vegetables. But they're both pickles.
They're both pickles. Yeah, that definitely clears it up. And I guess one other big difference would be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the lactic acid fermented pickles would also contain those probiotics. So in addition, like live probiotics. So in addition to eating your vegetable, you would also get that probiotic dose. But with the kind of grocery store aisle pickles, which are in vinegar, you don't get that probiotic boost.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then the one other thing I would point out is that, you know, one of the really important nutritional aspects of pickles has always been getting people vegetable nutrients in the winter, including vitamin C. But, you know, anytime you're cooking a vegetable, you're diminishing the vitamin C or fruit. So, you know, so yes, like a hot vinegar pickle does not have the probiotics, but it also has like much diminished levels of vitamin C because of the application of heat.
Okay, cool. Well, I know there are a number of ferments also that use not just bacteria, but also yeast. And maybe we could start with a discussion of, I don't know, maybe sourdough. Would that be a good example?
Sure. No, I mean, I love to talk about sourdough. Well, okay. I mean, yeast is very interesting because, you know, yeast is a word that we've been using in the English language for thousands of years. But yeast, in the sense that we know it now, has only been available commercially since the 20th century. So, you know, people have been working with yeast. People have been making bread. People have been making wine and beer for thousands of years. But this separate stuff, the fungus that we know as Saccharomyces cerevisiae, has only been commercially available for, you know, just over 100 years. And so, I mean, basically anything you could ferment with yeast already has yeast on it. All grapes, all fruit, all wheat, all grains have yeast on it. So, you know, but the yeast is never alone. The yeast is always in the company of bacteria. So, you know, what now gets called naturally fermented wines or natural wines. That's what all wine was until 100 years ago. Right now, in the world of beer, there's an explosion of sour beers. Well, until the 20th century, there was no such thing as a beer that wasn't sour because the yeast was always in the company of lactic acid bacteria. So all beer had a little bit of a sour edge to it. And then in the realm of bread, you know, natural leavening, what we call a sourdough, is, you know, basically the community of organisms that's found on wheat or rye or other grains that includes yeast, also includes lactic acid bacteria, includes other bacteria. And I mean, sourdough bread is superior to pure yeast bread in many different ways. I mean, the most observable, I think, is flavor. It just has, you know, greater flavor complexity. Another one is nutritional. The minerals in the grains become much more accessible as a result of the bacterial fermentation, which can break down these chemical bonds called phytate bonds, which otherwise make the minerals in grains inaccessible to us. So there's higher mineral content in them, as well as a better flavor. Now, in terms of gluten, the protein that so many people have a hard time digesting, bacterial fermentation actually breaks down gluten. So you have a significantly lower gluten content, not zero, but you have a significantly lower gluten content in a fermented bread, a bacterially fermented bread, a sourdough or naturally leavened bread than in a pure yeast bread. So, and then on the other end, after you bake the bread, it lasts much longer because of the acidity. So it stays fresh for a much longer period of time. So, I mean, I would say everything is superior about a sourdough bread in terms of, you know, flavor, nutrition, perishability. The only thing is it takes more time to produce and it takes a little bit more, you know, nuanced technique. You can only develop through experience.
That's fascinating what you said about gluten. You know, I haven't thought about that historically. We've moved to yeast-only breads, like you said, in the past century. But historically, humans have had, you know, lower gluten levels in their bread because of the bacterial composition in the ferment. That's fascinating and has, I think, implications for our health and how we've evolved with some of these plants. That's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mean, yeast as we know it today is a real departure from our history of how we've worked with these foods. And we've been, you know, like human cultures around the world have been working with yeast for thousands of years, but never alone. It's always in the company of other bacteria. And that's a really important thing to understand about fermentation, is it's never, or at least in historical fermentation, it's never the work of a singular organism. Because although microorganisms exist everywhere, they don't exist singularly. They exist in these elaborate communities. And so, you know, most fermentation techniques have something to do with narrowing the range of which organisms can function, but not down to one. It's always down to sort of a small handful, a community.
That's fascinating. I think our shift in food production has mirrored our shifts in medicine. Again, very reductionist, moving towards single compound drugs, away from more complex herbal medicines that we've used historically. It's the same kind of concept there. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about, if you have a sourdough culture, what actually is in that sourdough culture, and what are the steps to making a loaf of sourdough bread using those using the natural fermentation?
So I have been actually maintaining two sourdoughs. One that I started about 25 years ago, that is a wheat sourdough that I started with wheat and water. And I've been making bread and pancakes with it for 25 years. And then one that I've only had for the last maybe 2 or 3 years, that's a rye sourdough that I started with just rye flour, and I just used that to make a pure rye bread. But I just made bread a couple of days ago. And so if you're starting from scratch, all you need is flour and water. I would recommend whole wheat flour or rye flour. I mean, rye flour always starts the process faster. I can't say exactly why. I don't fully understand that. But, you know, and you can go back and forth between rye and wheat. You don't have to maintain two different starters. I just happened to be at a conference where I met somebody who had an old family rye starter, and I just was inspired by them, and I took some of their starter, and I've been perpetuating it. So you mix some flour and water together and leave it in a warm place. And you know, you don't have to create a specially warm place, just like on top of the fridge is typically a warm place, you know, maybe in a window, a place that heats up with some light, you know, just a marginally warmer spot. And then once it starts to get bubbly in a day or so, then take a small amount of that and add it to a larger amount of fresh flour and water. And if you repeat that a few times, you'll end up with something really bubbly. And the reason why that's called feeding the sourdough. And the reason why I say take a little bit of your starter and feed a larger amount of fresh flour and water to it, is that dilutes the acidity and enables the yeast to really, really flourish. And, you know, you can really see the flourishing of the yeast in terms of bubbling, and the bubbling will get more and more vigorous. I basically like to do what a baker would call 100% hydration for my starter. So about the same weight of flour and water, which by volume means more flour than water. But you don't have to, you don't need a scale. You don't have to be precise with it. You know, what that will get you is like a very thick liquid, like a pourable liquid, just on the edge of liquidity and solidity. People do it in ways. Some people swear by a liquid starter, some people swear by a solid starter. I like to get it like right in the middle between those things. And then I think of it as like winding it up. So I always do like a couple of feedings before I make bread. You know, in rapid succession. If I go away for months, I just leave it in the refrigerator, but then it takes a little bit of winding up, feeding a small amount of starter to a larger amount of fresh flour and water. And some books recommend just discarding the excess starter. What I do is I make pancakes with it. I'll put sourdough starter, maybe with leftover oatmeal or leftover rice and some flour and water, and then I'll add some vegetables to it, and I'll make these like savory vegetable pancakes. Right now, I have a batch sitting on my counter right now that I made with some leftover purple sweet potatoes, and so the batter itself has just gotten this bright purple color. It's beautiful. But I mean, that's how you create a starter. And then, I mean, you know, there's such a robust literature. I mean, so what I do is I usually start in the morning. I've wound up my starter by generally feeding it twice the day before, in the morning and then in the evening. And then the following morning, I'll make a dough, mix some of my starter with warm water and flour. And I'll make my dough. I like to do this thing that in French they call it the autolyse. I like to let the water absorb into the flour before I add salt, because salt really affects the fluid dynamics of the water. So I let it absorb in first, and then I add the salt. Mm-hmm. And then over the course of a few hours, you know, as often as I think about it, every half hour, every hour, I turn the dough. I do a couple of folds of the dough. It's sort of it's a way of kneading it, and also of you know, maintaining staying in touch with it as it's developing. And then at some point in the afternoon, I'll divide it into loaf pans. Not into loaf pans, but into individual sized loaves. And then I put it in a cloth lined basket for its final rise. And then what I often will do is put it in the refrigerator overnight, or put it outside on the porch overnight, is what I did the other night, because it was more or less refrigerator temperatures. And that retards the yeast fermentation, but allows the bacterial fermentation to continue. So I get a more sour flavor. I get more of the gluten broken down. And then in the morning, I'll bake it.
Wow. It's there are many steps, but I think they're pretty simple to handle once you get a hang of it. That's really interesting.
I would recommend that my book Wild Fermentation, I learned a lot about baking bread from the time I wrote Wild Fermentation originally in 2003 till the time I revised it in 2016. So I'd say in the revised edition with the orange and pink cover, I have much better bread recipes than in the original book that came out in 2003 with the green cover. I really try to like lay it out in a you know, easy to follow, step by step way.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and I definitely love your book. It's one of my favorites that I have in my list of cookbooks that I have here. And where can you find your book? I know you have it on your website, wildfermentation.com, but you can also get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and places like that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, wherever you get books, you should be able to find it. I have Wild Fermentation, and then also The Art of Fermentation, which is a much more in-depth book. My publisher is Chelsea Green, and they're pretty widely available.
That's great. Well, let's talk a bit about The Art of Fermentation, because I kind of see that as your global tour de force of so many different traditions, cultural traditions of fermentation. Let's talk about, like, what are some of your most interesting types of ferments that you've explored or tasted during your travels?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's really exciting to me is how varied fermentation is. And I mean, that's the thing that keeps it interesting. I mean, I do love sauerkraut. I'm very devoted to sauerkraut. I always have sauerkraut going. I always have different types of sauerkraut. But that's not the end of the story of fermentation. That's really, like, for me, the beginning of the story. But anything can be fermented. Something that I learned just a couple of years ago from a student of mine, a Thai American student, showed up with NAM. And in this case, it was ribs, pork ribs, in a little paste of rice, garlic, and salt that had been fermenting for a few days before he arrived. And we fermented for a few more days, and then we cooked them, and they were so good. Mm. And, you know, and that, 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 The major limitation with preserving meat or fish through fermentation is that the nutrients that ferment into acids, what we could call biopreservatives, are carbohydrates. And that's really, you know, the nutritional component that is lacking in most meat and fish. So, you know, like across Asia, there are all of these like incredibly interesting ways of fermenting fish and fish and meat in rice. And the rice provides the carbohydrate that produces the acids that enable the meat or the fish to effectively be preserved. So, you know, NAM is a very short-term version of this, where you're just fermenting for 3 to 5 days and then you're cooking them. And, you know, certainly my comfort level doing this and then cooking them is much greater, and especially with sharing with people. But, I mean, in my travels, I've experienced, you know, quite a few variations of this type of thing that are not cooked. They're just, you know, fermented in rice and then eaten, including I've had sushi that way. And if you think about, you know, the sushi that has gone global, the sushi that, you know, you and I and all of your listeners have enjoyed, you know, that's very fresh fish. Would you eat at a sushi restaurant that didn't have a refrigerator? So, you know, historically, sushi has been something different, and sushi has been a way of preserving fish in a bed of rice. And when I traveled to Japan, I was able to taste, you know, several different variants of this with different kinds of fish fermented for different periods of time. And that was really, really interesting and instructive. In China, too, and in a small village in China that I got to spend some time in, you know, every household had a crock filled with carp, a freshwater fish, fermented in rice and chilies and salt and Sichuan peppercorns. It was like it was a spiced mixture, but rice was the base. So, you know, this is a very interesting pattern of fermentation that I have, you know, very much enjoyed.
That's great. And so just to be clear on how the fish are being cured, is it just because you're increasing the acidity of the solution with the rice? It's kind of like a vinegar cure, but it's not vinegar. It would be lactic acid or some other, or would it be acetic acid?
No, it would be, it's lactic acid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. That's really interesting. Well, one thing we haven't spoken much about is also dairy and fermenting dairy. What are some of the more interesting dairy products that you've seen, and how are those made?
Well, I mean, cheese. I mean, fresh milk as we grew up drinking it is a 20th century phenomenon. Because, I mean, other than the family milking the cows or milking the goats, who could have fresh milk if you don't have refrigerators? The ways in which milk has been enjoyed as a food are all fermentation. So, you know, virtually all cheeses involve fermentation. You know, the ingredients of a blue cheese are exactly the same as the ingredients of a cheddar cheese or the ingredients of a brie cheese. And, you know, the only difference is, you know, the aging environment. Well, I mean, some of the manipulations, but they all involve just milk and salt. And in modern production, cultures might be added, but in historical production, cultures aren't added. The cultures are in the milk, and, you know, depending on the environment of the aging, different organisms are able to flourish.
And so when we ferment dairy, does that also have an impact on lactose? I know that some people have lactose intolerance. I'm just wondering how much fermentation depletes lactose in different kinds of dairy products.
Sure. So lactose is a sugar that's found in milk. And, you know, that's what lactic acid bacteria are eating up, is lactose. So, you know, okay, let's talk about yogurt. So obviously, you know, yogurt, everybody understands, is a fermented food. You know, what gives yogurt its acidity is lactic acid metabolized from lactose. But in marketing in the United States, the assumption is people want their yogurt to be as minimally sour as possible. They want it to be set, but they don't want it to be extremely sour. So most commercial yogurt in the U.S. is fermented for approximately 2.5 hours. So that's enough to set the yogurt, but certainly not enough to consume all of the lactose, because if you consume all of the lactose and transform it into lactic acid, it will have a much more pronounced sourness. So if you when I make my yogurt, I usually let it ferment for 8 to 12 hours. Sometimes I'll just leave it overnight and let it go for 16 hours. And so I'm making a product that has a more pronounced sour flavor, but also much lower lactose content. So I would say, like, if you're looking to minimize the lactose content of yogurt, you want to probably make it yourself and ferment it for a longer period of time, so that more of that milk sugar can be metabolized into lactic acid.
Yeah, I think I had no idea that was such a short fermentation process in industrial yogurt making here. I think one of the most frustrating things for me as a parent looking for healthy food options for my kids is that so many of the yogurts in the U.S. are just filled with corn syrup or sugar, which is not how they're made traditionally, of course, in other parts of the world. Can you tell us a little bit more about other kinds of yogurt products? Like, I'm thinking of things like kefir and kos from the Balkans, Greek yogurt. What are the differences in those types of yogurts and how they're made traditionally versus how we might get them industrially?
One thing I would say is, like, you know, every brand of yogurt also makes plain yogurt. In addition to the, you know, the very sweet yogurt, you can buy plain yogurt. And I mean, I would recommend buying plain yogurt and then you know, dolling it up as you like it. But, like, you know, eat some plain, like, just learn mm-hmm. to learn, enjoy the flavor of yogurt itself. And also think about yogurt not only as a vehicle for sugar and fruit and sweet flavors, but yogurt as a vehicle for savory flavors. You know, spiced yogurts like tzatziki, they're beautiful condiments that can embellish all kinds of other foods. I talked about the savory pancakes that I make. Well, I love to make yogurt-based savory condiments with them. I'll mix yogurt with hot sauce and make yogurt hot sauce. The other day we made some chickweed pesto with chickweed that grows as a weed around the house and in the garden. And then we had leftover pesto and we had made a yogurt pesto sauce for the pancakes. So I think, you know, yogurt is really, really versatile, and I would always encourage people to buy it plain and doll it up themselves and, you know, vary the ways that they doll it up so that yogurt doesn't become associated only as, like, you know, as like a candy, as something that's extremely sweet. Sure, it can be delicious like that, but that's not the only way or the major way to enjoy a yogurt. Greek yogurt is, I think it's a real misnomer, because I mean all over the yogurt regions of the world, in Lebanon and in Turkey, they strain yogurt also. I mean, everywhere where yogurt is an important food, yogurt is sometimes strained, and that's all Greek yogurt is. Either in a couple of layers of tightly woven cheesecloth, or just in any piece of cotton. You don't need cheesecloth. You know, take a piece of an old sheet, a clean pair of socks, or a piece of a pillowcase, like any clean, tightly woven cloth. If you put some yogurt in it and hang it, whey will drip out and the yogurt inside will get thicker and thicker. and you can let it just get a little bit thick, which is sort of like what the, you know, products that are being called Greek yogurt are, or you can let it go, you can let it go all day and you'll end up with something like cream cheese, you know, different kinds of cheeses. Now, kefir is a totally different thing. It's another style of a fermented milk. And generally, if people say a fermented milk, what they mean is the entirety of the milk fermented. Whereas with cheese, cheese is also fermented, but cheese, you're always losing some of the liquid portion of the milk, the whey. So there's always some curdling involved in cheese, and you're removing the bulk of the of the whey, or different proportions of the whey depending on the cheese. A very hard, dense cheese, you lose more of the whey than a soft cheese. But fermented milk products, I mean, every part of the world where people developed, where people domesticated animals for their milk, they developed distinctive styles of fermenting milk. And, you know, like Scandinavia has an kind of outrageous variety of fermented milks. You know, some places in Africa have really interesting variants of fermented milk. But there's a lot of different types of fermented milk beyond yogurt. And, you know, the runner-up for global popularity would be kefir. And kefir, kefir is made with a SCOBY, maybe analogous to the SCOBY that's used for making kombucha. But whereas the kombucha SCOBY, the mother of kombucha, is like a little rubbery pancake, kefir SCOBYs are called grains, and they look, they're these like little rubbery blobs that look something like florets of cauliflower, and you can get your hands on them through the internet. They're quite widely available, and you know, you just take these kefir grains and you plop them in milk in this elaborate community of organisms that that the kefir grains are host to. And you know, it's 30 something organisms. They coordinate their reproduction. They spin this rubbery polysaccharide skin that they share as a home. And when you put it in milk, they digest lactose and they break down lactose. And that the 30 odd organisms that are part of the kefir grains grow into the milk. Some of the lactose ends up enabling those grains to grow. But then also those same organisms grow into all that milk. So, you know, drinking kefir, it's not as thick as yogurt. It's like a drinkable fermented milk. And one of the elements in there is yeast. So there's always like a negligible proportion of alcohol, but also it gets bubbly, like with bubbles of carbon dioxide. So sometimes kefir is called the champagne of milks, and it can be really, really delicious, and it's extremely biodiverse and an excellent probiotic.
Wow, that sounds delicious. And again, really things that are easy to apply at home once you kind of get your hands on the techniques. Well, I'm going to wrap up with just one last question. If there's any lesson that you'd like to share with the listeners about fermentation that have really guided you in your journey around this culinary technique, what would it be?
Well, I mean, one thing I just want to say is that, like, you know, you know, probiotics, like, you know, these bacteria that are in these, primarily the lactic acid bacteria, you know, really can, you know, help to improve our overall health. And I hesitate to make specific claims because I think that the benefit of them is really general. You know, they can help improve digestion. They can help improve overall immune function. There's some new evidence suggesting that they can potentially help improve mental health. And, you know, who can't benefit from improved digestion, improved immune function, and improved mental health? So, you know, while I think it's, you know, I think it's not reasonable to, you know, tout fermented vegetables as like, you know, a cure to specific disease processes. You know, I think that in terms of enhancing health, you know, they can be very, very powerful. And, you know, I would encourage people, you know, especially in this time of, you know, health anxiety, to just, you know, think about nutrition and overall nutrition and, you know, things that can improve overall immune function. And so that's the first thing that I want to say. In terms of what to ferment, I mean, whatever you have a lot of. I mean, what I've learned from playing around with fermenting vegetables is that there's no vegetable you can't ferment. I mean, it doesn't mean every vegetable is going to necessarily be equally delicious to you. I mean, we all have preferences. We won't necessarily all agree on which vegetables ferment the best. You know, don't be afraid to experiment. There's no reason to be afraid to experiment, but experiment in small batches. You know, don't make a 50-gallon batch of zucchini kraut, you know, before you've experimented a little bit. And, you know, I mean, my experience is zucchini kraut can actually be incredibly delicious, but it gets soft and mushy before too long. So, you know, I don't know how practical it would be to do a 50-gallon crock of it. But, you know, most people aren't thinking about 50-gallon crocks. They're thinking of, you know, a quart to, give them a little easy, quick vegetable side dish on demand. And, you know, that's really how I use these things.
That's great. Well, in addition to your excellent books, The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, you also lead a number of workshops. So I know right now things are slow because of the social isolation period right now with COVID-19. But where can listeners find information about future schedules that you'll have for future workshops? And I know you do these globally, so it could be of interest to many of the listeners.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I have a website, wildfermentation.com, and I list all of my workshops on there. You know, everything I had scheduled for the next couple of months has been canceled. And we don't really know beyond that, but you know, I would expect that when this passes, that you know, I will be teaching workshops in different places. But the way to find out is on my website, wildfermentation.com. And you know, actually, I'll be doing some online kinds of things, and I'll be posting them on there as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. I look forward to watching those. Well, thank you so much, Sandor, for coming on the show. This has been really informative and very useful. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about how to start fermenting your own foods at home, definitely check out Sandor's books, Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, available with all major booksellers. You can find more links to his workshops and online lessons in fermentation on his website at www.wildfermentation.com. And you can also follow him on Instagram at Sandor Kraut, spelled SandorKraut. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, recorded on Skype from home during the COVID-19 isolation period. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or on Apple Podcasts. We've got a fabulous lineup of topics and shows for you this season, so be sure to mark your calendars because new episodes release every Monday. Help us out by also sharing links to your favorite shows with your friends. We'd love to reach a broader audience. Also, if you like the show, please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts and spread the word. Thanks so much for listening. Stay healthy, everyone, and I'll see you next time.